Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Carl Safina is with us, and so is Bill Russell, of course. Bill was in the middle of a sentence when I so rudely interrupted. Where were we, please?
Well, I ask about that partly because...
You mean the getting tired and
Well, the getting tired and the...
stormy stuff?
And dealing with storms, because presumably they're really significant adaptations, as you've said. Adaptations that have occurred over a long period of time. And they're startling and amazingly effective. But it raises the question of if there are in fact substantive changes going on in the space, the world that these creatures inhabit, and people will say that humans are beginning to have those kinds of effects, then it would seem that it would put these various adaptations at serious risk. Is that part of what's going on out there?
One of the most heartbreaking things is to see how adaptations that have been tuned to such extremes over such a long period of time are exactly those things that people exploit. They go from being the strongest part of how the bird survives to the weakest link in its ability to cope with people.
Being
able to travel enormous distances so that you can breed on islands that have no predators. Otherwise, you could just breed on the continent. Right, and life could be relatively simpler and easier. But in order to get the benefit of breeding on tiny little distant islands to get away from all the predators, that's the benefit, you have to develop this other extreme suite of ability to travel and to find food in far-flung places. And suddenly humans arrive on those little islands, which the birds were crowding into by the millions just to get away from predators, and suddenly they're all there crowded in by the millions, and there is one predator who is a sentient being systematically intent on killing every single one that they can find so that they can sell their feathers.
Yeah, it's talking about feathers and humans in this case very much as predators. You speak of one of the species where in the 1900s, the humans got this lust for bird feathers, for hats, for ladies in Europe mostly, I guess,
and
North
America.
And we almost wiped out the birds taking their feathers for hats, for women's couture. And then when we kind of get past that fad, then comes the Second World War, and then comes the Cold War, and humans keep coming back at these creatures with dramatically different needs, but every time that the humans have come into it, and then now recently, it isn't so much aggressive, but all the plastics that the birds have to deal with.
Right.
And that's before you start talking about the rats and the rabbits and the other creatures that humans have introduced to those places.
Right.
How do the birds stand up to this?
They just continue to try to carry out their lives in the way that they know how to do it.
They're not adapted to this kind of predator.
Well, nothing is really adapted to people who come with the idea of killing all of them, and groups of people are not adapted to coping with that either. And the birds fared no better than many groups of people have fared in the face of a similar sort of Holocaust. A lot of that intended killing is behind us now, and most of the killing now is accidental killing in fishing gear. Some of the birds are able to cope with that level. It's a matter of rate of kill, and some of them are not and are declining slowly. But these distant islands are wonderful havens until people set foot on them, and then they become prisons for these birds, or turtles, or seals.
You have done a magnificent job in both of your books describing the seas and the challenges and the good news. And one of the things that, when I was going through that list, I failed to talk about drift nets, which came and were devastating, 40 miles of death on the water all over the ocean. But you call Eye of the Albatross visions of hope and survival. And what you've done, especially in this one, is to say, yes, and it was terrible, and some of it still is pretty terrible, and we have some real opportunities for things to start getting better.
Some things are getting better. That's, I think, an important point. There are a lot of horrible things happened, And there has been a recovery from a lot of those horrible things for many animals in many places on these islands that I talk about. It's not as bad as it was, but the somewhat paradoxical trade-off is that in the past, people came to those islands intent on killing all the birds, all the turtles, all the seals that they could find and converting them into money. And many of them just absolutely could not withstand that and crashed to very, very low levels. The largest albatross in the Pacific, the short-tailed albatross, was believed extinct for 20 years. Nobody saw one. And now there are 1,500 of them, which is a relatively very low level, but it's a lot better than not being seen for 20 years. So they're starting to come back. Green turtles around Hawaii are starting to come back. The albatrosses and the other seabirds are starting to come back. People have eradicated the rats on some of the islands, and the birds have begun to really rebound. All of that is really good, and it's a positive trend, especially in the North Pacific. In other parts of the world, animals on these islands still have trouble of various kinds with people. But there's a much more pervasive threat for all the albatrosses now, just to focus on the albatrosses for a moment. And that is, in the past, when people came ashore on these islands, they were always bound to miss some of them, or many of them would have been at sea as juveniles for a number of years and just simply not subject to what was happening on the islands. Now you have this fishing gear, which is all over the world, and for birds that live for 4 or 5 decades, their chances of being around fishing gear and fishing boats are 100%, you know, virtually every week of their foraging lifetimes. And they're always exposed to the danger and the hazards of that. And the chances of getting clipped once or getting snagged on a hook and drowned once are relatively high for any individual over the course of such a long life. It's a much more pervasive risk, although the rate of killing is not millions of birds a year as it first was when people first set foot on those islands with that intention. But
it's still one out of a lower number.
Even if it's still tens of thousands every year globally, it adds up enough to slowly drive populations down in some places or to inhibit their recovery in other places. But the good news is that there are some simple techniques that can be used by fishing boats so that seabirds don't get killed in the course of the operations, or very, very, very few of them would get killed. And those techniques are now beginning to be adopted. Conservation groups are trying to force this to happen. Some fishing groups, particularly the Alaska black cod and halibut fishermen, have been leaders and saying that, you know, we don't want to kill seabirds. We also don't want the bad publicity. We also know that under the Endangered Species Act, if we kill too many, we'll be shut down. We don't want to be shut down. So it's good PR. It's the right thing to do. And plus, we want to keep fishing. So we'll do these few simple things. And this is being adopted more and more. So there are solutions. And that's why the subtitle of the book is Visions of Hope and Survival, because I personally don't think that the future for these birds is as bleak as it would be, because people are starting to do some of the things that are necessary to ensure their survival.
But you're not telling us to have false hope here.
No, not false hope, real hope. And the more you have real hope, the more you'll be willing to work at it. I think sometimes we have a false sense of disgust and a false sense of hopelessness and a false sense that nothing we can do matters and why bother? That I think is a lot falser than the hope that if we exert some energy towards solutions, we'll actually solve some problems. I think that's a more realistic view of things.
You talked earlier about learning and humans' ability to learn, and the story, talking about Alaska, you present a wonderful contrast, or a remarkable contrast, between the learning that apparently has occurred amongst people in that fisheries area compared to the learning that apparently has yet to happen in the North Atlantic, both of which were at one point bounteous fishing resources. They were just, for 500 years, the North Atlantic fed people all over in at least Europe and America, and that doesn't happen the way it used to. But the learning and the difference between what's happened in Alaska and what's happened in the North Atlantic, what's the difference?
The difference is just a certain kind of traditional approach to fishing. And in the North Atlantic, there's a long tradition of assuming inexhaustibility. There's been a lot of crowding. There's been a lot of competition, and not a sense of restraint in any way, and a denial that people can actually affect what's happening in the oceans. In the North Pacific, the people who pioneered some of those fisheries just didn't feel that way about it. They had a different approach. They felt that the resources in the ocean were that people could affect the abundance of fish by catching them, and they have operated based under that assumption.
Bill, you can have the rest of that question when we come back in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell will continue the conversation when we return with Carl Savina. Please be with us.